Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. The Outlaws by Selma Lagerlöf. A peasant who had murdered a monk took to the woods and was made an outlaw. He found there before him in the wilderness another outlaw, a fisherman from the outermost islands who had been accused of stealing a herring net. They joined together, lived in a cave, set snares, sharpened darts, baked bread on a granite rock, and guarded one another's lives. The peasant never left the woods, but the fisherman, who had not committed such an abominable crime, sometimes loaded game on his shoulders and stole down among men. There he got in exchange for black cocks, for long-haired hares, and fine-limbed red deer, milk and butter, arrowheads and clothes. These helped the outlaws to sustain life. The cave where they lived was dug in the side of a hill. Broad stones and thorny sloe bushes hid the entrance. Above it stood a thick-growing pine tree. At its roots was the vent hole of the cave. The rising smoke filtered through the tree's thick branches and vanished into space. The men used to go to and from their dwelling place, wading in the mountain stream which ran down the hill. No one looked for their tracks under the merry, bubbling water. At first they were hunted like wild beasts. The peasants gathered as if for a chase of bear or wolf. The wood was surrounded by men with bows and arrows. Men with spears went through it and left no dark crevice, no bushy thicket unexplored. While the noisy Batu hunted through the wood, the outlaws lay in their dark hole, listening breathlessly, panting with terror. The fishermen held out a whole day, but he who had murdered was driven by unbearable fear out into the open, where he could see his enemy. He was seen and hunted, but it seemed to him 7 times better than to lie still in helpless inactivity. He fled from his pursuers, slid down precipices, sprang over streams, climbed up perpendicular mountain walls. All latent strength and dexterity in him was called forth by the excitement of danger. His body became elastic like a steel spring. His foot made no false step. His hand never lost its hold. Eye and ear were twice as sharp as usual. He understood what the leaves whispered and the rocks warned. When he had climbed up a precipice, he turned toward his pursuers, sending them jibes in biting rhyme. When the whistling darts whizzed by him, he caught them, swift as lightning, and hurled them down on his enemies. As he forced his way through whipping branches, something within him sang a song of triumph. The bald mountain ridge ran through the wood, and alone on its summit stood a lofty fir. The red-brown trunk was bare, but in the branching top rocked an eagle's nest. The fugitive was now so audaciously bold that he climbed up there while his pursuers looked for him on the wooded slopes. There he sat twisting the young eaglets' necks while the hunt passed by far below him. The male and female eagle, longing for revenge, swooped down on the ravisher. They fluttered before his face. They struck with their beaks at his eyes. They beat him with their wings and tore with their claws, bleeding weals in his weather-beaten skin. Laughing, he fought with them. Standing upright in the shaking nest, he cut at them with his sharp knife and forgot in the pleasure of the play his danger and his pursuers. When he found time to look for them, they had gone by to some other part of the forest. No one had thought to look for their prey on the bald mountain ridge. No one had raised his eyes to the clouds to see him practicing boyish tricks and sleepwalking feats while his life was in the greatest danger. The man trembled when he found that he was saved. With shaking hands, he caught at a support. Giddy, he measured the height to which he had climbed. And moaning with the fear of falling, afraid of the birds, afraid of being seen, afraid of everything, he slid down the trunk. He laid himself down on the ground so as not to be seen and dragged himself forward over the rocks until the underbrush covered him. There he hid himself under the young pine tree's tangled branches. Weak and powerless, he sank down on the moss. A single man could have captured him. Tord was the fisherman's name. He was not more than 16 years old, but strong and bold. He had already lived a year in the woods. The peasant's name was Berg, with the surname Rees. He was the tallest and the strongest man in the whole district, and moreover handsome and well-built. He was broad in the shoulders and slender in the waist. His hands were as well shaped as if he had never done any hard work. His hair was brown and his skin fair. After he had been some time in the woods, he acquired in all ways a more formidable appearance. His eyes became piercing, his eyebrows grew bushy, and the muscles which knitted them lay finger-thick above his nose. It showed now more plainly than before how the upper part of his athlete's brow projected over the lower. His lips closed more firmly than of old. His whole face was thinner, the hollows at the temples grew very deep, and his powerful jaw was much more prominent. His body was less well filled out, but his muscles were as hard as steel. His hair grew suddenly gray. Young Tord never could weary of looking at this man. He had never before seen anything so beautiful and powerful. In his imagination, he stood high as the forest, strong as the sea. He served him as a master and worshipped him as a god. It was a matter of course that Tord should carry the hunting spears, drag home the game, fetch the water, and build the fire. Berg Rhys accepted all his services, but almost never gave him a friendly word. He despised him because he was a thief. The outlaws did not lead a robber's or brigand's life. They supported themselves by hunting and fishing. If Berg Rhys had not murdered a holy man, the peasants would soon have ceased to pursue him and have left him in peace in the mountains. But they feared great disaster to the district, because he who had raised his hand against a servant of God was still unpunished. When Tord came down to the valley with game, they offered him riches and pardon for his own crime if he would show them the way to Berg Rhys's hole, so they might take him while he slept. But the boy always refused, and if anyone tried to sneak up after him to the wood, he led him so cleverly astray that he gave up the pursuit. Once Berg asked him if the peasants had not tried to tempt him to betray him, and when he had heard what they had offered him as a reward, he said scornfully that Tord had been foolish not to accept such a proposal. Then Tord looked at him with a glance, the like of which Berg Rhys had never seen before. Never had any beautiful woman in his youth, never had his wife or child looked so at him. "You are my lord, my elected master," said the glance. "Know that you may strike me and abuse me as you will. I am faithful notwithstanding." After that, Berg Rhys paid more attention to the boy and noticed that he was bold to act but timid to speak. He had no fear of death. When the ponds were first frozen, or when the bogs were most dangerous in the spring, when the quagmires were hidden under richly flowering grasses and cloudberry, he took his way over them by choice. He seemed to feel the need of exposing himself to danger as a compensation for the storms and terrors of the ocean, which he had no longer to meet. At night he was afraid in the woods, and even in the middle of the day the darkest thickets or the wide-stretching roots of a fallen pine could frighten him. But when Berg Rhys asked him about it, he was too shy to even answer. Tord did not sleep near the fire, far in the cave, on the bed which was made soft with moss and warm with skins. But every night, when Berg had fallen asleep, he crept out to the entrance and lay there on a rock. Berg discovered this, and although he well understood the reason, he asked what it meant. Tord would not explain. To escape any more questions, he did not lie at the door for 2 nights, but then he returned to his spot. One night, when the drifting snow whirled about the forest tops and drove into the thickest underbrush, the driving snowflakes found their way into the outlaw's cave. Tord, who lay just inside the entrance, was, when he waked in the morning, covered by a melting snowdrift. A few days later he fell ill. His lungs wheezed, and when they were expanded to take in air, he felt excruciating pain. He kept up as long as his strength held out, but when one evening he leaned down to blow the fire, he fell over and remained lying. Berg Rhys came to him and told him to go to his bed. Tord moaned with pain and could not raise himself. Berg then thrust his arms under him and carried him there, but he felt as if he had got hold of a slimy snake. He had a taste in the mouth as if he had eaten the unholy horse flesh. It was so odious to him to touch the miserable thief. He laid his own big bearskin over him and gave him water. More he could not do. Nor was it anything dangerous. Tord was soon well again. But through Berg's being obliged to do his tasks and to be his servant, they had come nearer to one another. Tord dared to talk to him when he sat in the cave in the evening and cut arrow shafts. "You are of a good race, Berg," said Tord. "Your kinsmen are the richest in the valley. Your ancestors have served with kings and fought in their castles." They have oftener fought with bands of rebels and done the king's great injury, replied Burg Rhys. Your ancestors gave great feasts at Christmas, and so did you when you were at home. Hundreds of men and women could find a place to sit in your big house, which was already built before St. Olaf first gave the baptism here in Viken. You owned old silver vessels and great drinking horns, which passed from man to man, filled with mead. Again Burg Rhys had to look at the boy. He sat up with his legs hanging out of the bed and his head resting on his hands, with which he at the same time held back the wild masses of hair which would fall over his eyes. His face had become pale and delicate from the ravages of sickness. In his eyes, fever still burned. He smiled at the pictures he conjured up, at the adorned house, at the silver vessels, at the guests in gala array, and at Burg Rhys, sitting in the seat of honor in the hall of his ancestors. The peasant thought that no one had ever looked at him with such shining, admiring eyes, or thought him so magnificent, arrayed in his festival clothes, as that boy thought him in the torn skin dress. He was both touched and provoked. That miserable thief had no right to admire him. "Were there no feasts in your house?" he asked. Tord laughed. "Out there on the rocks with father and mother? Father is a wrecker and mother is a witch. No one will come to us." "Is your mother a witch?" "She is," answered Tord, quite untroubled. "In stormy weather she rides out on a seal to meet the ships over which the waves are washing, and those who are carried overboard are hers." "What does she do with them?" asked Berg. "Oh, a witch always needs corpses. She makes ointments out of them, or perhaps she eats them. On moonlight nights she sits in the surf where it is whitest, and the spray dashes over her. They say that she sits and searches for shipwrecked children's fingers and eyes." "That is awful," said Berg. The boy answered with infinite assurance. "That would be awful in others, but not in witches. They have to do so." Burg Rhys found that he had here come upon a new way of regarding the world and things. "Do thieves have to steal as witches have to use witchcraft?" he asked sharply. "Yes, of course," answered the boy. "Everyone has to do what he is destined to do." But then he added with a cautious smile, "There are thieves also who have never stolen." "Say out what you mean," said Berg. The boy continued with his mysterious smile, proud at being an unsolvable riddle. "It is like speaking of birds who do not fly, to talk of thieves who do not steal." Berg Rhys pretended to be stupid in order to find out what he wanted. "No one can be called a thief without having stolen," he said. "No, but," said the boy, and pressed his lips together as if to keep in the words, "but if someone had a father who stole," he hinted after a while. "One inherits money and lands," replied Burg Rhys, "but no one bears the name of thief if he has not himself earned it." Tord laughed quietly. "But if somebody has a mother who begs and prays him to take his father's crime on him, but if such a one cheats the hangman and escapes to the woods, but if someone is made an outlaw for a fishnet which he has never seen." Burg Rhys struck the stone table with his clenched fist. He was angry. This fair young man had thrown away his whole life. He could never win love, nor riches, nor esteem after that. The wretched striving for food and clothes was all which was left him, and the fool had let him, Burg Rhys, go on despising one who was innocent. He rebuked him with stern words, but Tord was not even as afraid as a sick child is of its mother when she chides it because it is caught cold by wading in the spring brooks. On one of the broad wooded mountains lay a dark tarn. It was square, with as straight shores and as sharp corners as if it had been cut by the hand of man. On three sides it was surrounded by steep cliffs, on which pines clung with roots as thick as a man's arm. Down by the pool, where the earth had been gradually washed away, their roots stood up out of the water, bare and crooked and wonderfully twisted about one another. It was like an infinite number of serpents which had wanted all at the same time to crawl up out of the pool but had got entangled in one another and been held fast. Or it was like a mass of blackened skeletons of drowned giants which the pool wanted to throw up on the land. Arms and legs writhed about one another. The long fingers dug deep into the very cliff to get a hold. The mighty ribs formed arches which held up primeval trees. It had happened, however, that the iron arms, the steel-like fingers with which the pines held themselves fast, had given way, and a pine had been borne by a mighty north wind from the top of the cliff down to the pool. It had burrowed deep down into the muddy bottom with its top and now stood there. The smaller fish had a good place of refuge among its branches, but the roots stuck up above the water like a many-armed monster and contributed to make the pool awful and terrifying. On the tarn's fourth side, the cliff sank down. There, a little foaming stream carried away its waters. Before this stream could find the only possible way, it had tried to get out between stones and tufts, and had, by so doing, made a little world of islands, some no bigger than a little hillock, others covered with trees. Here, where the encircling cliffs did not shut out all the sun, leafy trees flourished. Here stood thirsty gray-green alders and smooth-leaved willows. The birch tree grew there, as it does everywhere, when it's trying to crowd out the pine woods, and the wild cherry and the mountain ash, those two which edged the forest pastures, filling them with fragrance and adorning them with beauty. Here at the outlet there was a forest of reeds as high as a man, which made the sunlight fall green on the water just as it falls on the moss in the real forest. Among the reeds there were open places. Small round pools and water lilies were floating there. The tall stalks looked down with mild seriousness on those sensitive beauties, who discontentedly shut their white petals and yellow stamens in a hard leather-like sheath as soon as the sun ceased to show itself. One sunshiny day, the outlaws came to this tarn to fish. They waded out to a couple of big stones in the midst of the reed forest and sat there and threw out bait for the big green-striped pickerel that lay and slept near the surface of the water. These men, who were always wandering in the woods and the mountains, had, without their knowing it themselves, come under nature's rule as much as the plants and the animals. When the sun shone, they were open-hearted and brave, but in the evening, as soon as the sun had disappeared, they became silent, and the night, which seemed to them much greater and more powerful than the day, made them anxious and helpless. Now the green light, which slanted in between the rushes and colored the water with brown and dark green streaked with gold, affected their mood until they were ready for any miracle. Every outlook was shut off. Sometimes the reeds rocked in an imperceptible wind, their stalks rustled, and the long ribbon-like leaves fluttered against their faces. They sat in gray skins on the gray stones. The shadows in the skins repeated the shadows of the weather-beaten mossy stone. Each saw his companion in his silence and immovability change into a stone image. But in among the rushes swam mighty fishes with rainbow-colored backs. When the men threw out their hooks and saw the circle spreading among the reeds, it seemed as if the motion grew stronger and stronger, until they perceived that it was not caused only by their cast. A sea nymph, half human, half a shining fish, lay and slept on the surface of the water. She lay on her back with her whole body under water. The waves so nearly covered her that they had not noticed her before. It was her breathing that caused the motion of the waves. But there was nothing strange in her lying there, and when the next instant she was gone, they were not sure she had not been only an illusion. The green light entered through the eyes into the brain like a gentle intoxication. The men sat and stared with dulled thoughts, seeing visions among the reeds, of which they did not dare to tell one another. The catch was poor. The day was devoted to dreams and apparitions. The stroke of oars was heard among the rushes, and they started up as if from sleep. The next moment, a flat-bottomed boat appeared, heavy, hollowed out with no skill, and with oars as small as sticks. A young girl, who had been picking water lilies, rowed it. She had dark brown hair, gathered in great braids, and big dark eyes. Otherwise she was strangely pale. But her paleness toned to pink, and not to gray. Her cheeks had no higher color than the rest of her face. The lips had hardly enough. She wore a white linen shirt and a leather belt with a gold buckle. Her skirt was blue with a red hem. She rode by the outlaws without seeing them. They kept breathlessly still, but not for fear of being seen, but only to be able to really see her. As soon as she had gone, they were as if changed from stone images to living beings. Smiling, they looked at one another. She was white like the water lily, said one. Her eyes were as dark as the water there under the pine roots. They were so excited that they wanted to laugh, really laugh as no one had ever laughed by that pool, till the cliffs thundered with echoes and the roots of the pines loosened with fright. Did you think she was pretty? Asked Berg Rhys. Oh, I do not know. I saw her for such a short time. Perhaps she was. I do not believe you dared to look at her. You thought that it was a mermaid. And they were again shaken by the same extravagant merriment. Tord had once, as a child, seen a drowned man. He had found the body on the shore on a summer day and had not been at all afraid, but at night he had dreamed terrible dreams. He saw a sea where every wave rolled a dead man to his feet. He saw, too, that all the islands were covered with drowned men who were dead and belonged to the sea, but who could still speak and move and threaten him with withered white hands. It was so with him now. The girl whom he had seen among the rushes came back in his dreams. He met her out in the open pool, where the sunlight fell even greener than among the rushes, and he had time to see that she was beautiful. He dreamed that he had crept up on the big pine root in the middle of the dark tarn, but the pines swayed and rocked, so sometimes he was quite under water. Then she came forward on the little islands. She stood under the red mountain ashes and laughed at him. In the last dream vision, he had come so far that she kissed him. It was already morning, and he heard that Berg Rhys had got up, but he obstinately shut his eyes to be able to go on with his dream. When he awoke, he was as though dizzy and stunned by what had happened to him in the night. He thought much more now of the girl than he had done the day before. Toward night, he happened to ask Berg Rhys if he knew her name. Berg looked at him inquiringly. "Perhaps it is best for you to hear it," he said. "She is Un. We are cousins." Tord then knew that it was for that pale girl's sake Berg Rhys wandered an outlaw in forest and mountain. Tord tried to remember what he knew of her. Un was the daughter of a rich peasant. Her mother was dead, so that she managed her father's house. This she liked, for she was fond of her own way, and she had no wish to be married. Un and Berg Rhys were the children of brothers, and it had long been said that Berg preferred to sit with Un and her maids and jest with them than to work on his own lands. When the great Christmas feast was celebrated at his house, his wife had invited a monk from Draxmark, for she wanted him to remonstrate with Berg because he was forgetting her for another woman. This monk was hateful to Berg and to many on account of his appearance. He was very fat and quite white. The ring of hair about his bald head, the eyebrows above his watery eyes, his face, his hands, and his whole cloak, everything was white. Many found it hard to endure his looks. At the banquet table, in the hearing of all the guests, this monk now said, for he was fearless and thought that his words would have more effect if they were heard by many, "People are in the habit of saying that the cuckoo is the worst of birds because he does not rear his young in his own nest. But here sits a man who does not provide for his home and his children, but seeks his pleasure with a strange woman. Him will I call the worst of men." Un then rose up. "That, Berg, is said to you and me," she said. "Never have I been so insulted, and my father is not here either." She had wished to go, but Berg sprang after her. "Do not move," she said. "I will never see you again." He caught up with her in the hall and asked her what he should do to make her stay. She had answered with flashing eyes that he must know that best himself. Then Berg went in and killed the monk. Berg and Tord were busy with the same thoughts, for after a while Berg said, "You should have seen her, Un, when the white monk fell. The mistress of the house gathered the small children about her and cursed her. She turned their faces toward her, that they might forever remember her who had made their father a murderer. But Un stood calm and so beautiful that the men trembled. She thanked me for the deed and told me to fly to the woods. She bade me not to be a robber and not to use the knife until I could do it for an equally just cause." "Your deed had been to her honor," said Tord. Berg Rhys noticed again what had astonished him before in the boy. He was like a heathen. Worse than a heathen, he never condemned what was wrong. He felt no responsibility. That which must be was. He knew of God and Christ and the saints, but only by name, as one knows the gods of foreign lands. The ghosts of the rocks were his god. His mother, wise in witchcraft, had taught him to believe in the spirits of the dead. Then Bergrise undertook a task which was as foolish as to twist a rope about his own neck. He set before those ignorant eyes the great God, the Lord of Justice, the Avenger of misdeeds, who cast the wicked into places of everlasting torment. And he taught him to love Christ and his mother and the holy men and women, who with lifted hands kneeled before God's throne to avert the wrath of the great Avenger from the hosts of sinners. He taught him all that men do to appease God's wrath. He showed him the crowds of pilgrims making pilgrimages to holy places, the flight of self-torturing penitents and monks from a worldly life. As he spoke, the boy became more eager and more pale. His eyes grew large as if for terrible visions. Bergrise wished to stop, but thoughts streamed to him and he went on speaking. The night sank down over them, the black forest night, when the owls hoot. God came so near to them that they saw his throne darken with the stars, and the chastising angels sank down to the tops of the trees. And under them the fires of hell flamed up to the earth's crust, eagerly licking that shaking place of refuge for the souring races of men. The autumn had come with a heavy storm. Tord went alone in the woods to see after the snares and traps. Bergrise sat at home to mend his clothes. Tord's way led in a broad path up a wooded height. Every gust carried the dry leaves in a rustling whirl up the path. Time after time, Tord thought that someone went behind him. He often looked round. Sometimes he stopped to listen, but he understood that it was the leaves and the wind and went on. As soon as he started on again, he heard someone come dancing on silken foot up the slope. Small feet came tripping. Elves and fairies played behind him. When he turned round, there was no one, always no one. He shook his fists at the rustling leaves and went on. They did not grow silent for that, but they took another tone. They began to hiss and to pant behind him. A big viper came gliding. Its tongue dripping venom hung far out of its mouth, and its bright body shone against the withered leaves. Beside the snake pattered a wolf, a big gaunt monster, who was ready to seize fast in his throat when the snake had twisted about his feet and bitten him in the heel. Sometimes they were both silent, as if to approach him unperceived, but they soon betrayed themselves by hissing and panting, and sometimes the wolf's claws wrung against a stone. Involuntarily, Tord walked quicker and quicker, but the creatures hastened after him. When he felt that they were only two steps distant and were preparing to strike, he turned. There was nothing there, and he had known it the whole time. He sat down on a stone to rest. Then the dry leaves played about his feet as if to amuse him. All the leaves of the forest were there, small, light, yellow birch leaves, red-speckled mountain ash, the elm's dry, dark brown leaves, the aspen's tough light red, and the willow's yellow-green. Transformed and withered, scarred and torn were they, and much unlike the downy, light-green, delicately shaped leaves, which a few months ago had rolled out of their buds. "Sinners," said the boy, "sinners, nothing is pure in God's eyes. The flame of his wrath has already reached you." When he resumed his wandering, he saw the forest under him bend before the storm like a heaving sea, but in the path it was calm. But he heard what he did not feel. The woods were full of voices. He heard whisperings, wailing songs, coarse threats, thundering oaths. There was laughter and laments. There was the noise of many people. That which hounded and pursued, which rustled and hissed, which seemed to be something and still was nothing, gave him wild thoughts. He felt again the anguish of death, as when he lay on the floor in his den and the peasants hunted him through the wood. He heard again the crashing of branches, the people's heavy tread, the ring of weapons, the resounding cries, the wild, bloodthirsty noise which followed the crowd. But it was not only that which he heard in the storm. There was something else, something still more terrible, voices which he could not interpret, a confusion of voices which seemed to him to speak in foreign tongues. He had heard mightier storms than this whistle through the rigging, but never before had he heard the wind play on such a many-voiced harp. Each tree had its own voice. The pine did not murmur like the aspen, nor the poplar like the mountain ash. Every hole had its note, every cliff sounding echo its own ring. and the noise of the brooks and the cry of the foxes mingled with the marvelous forest storm. But all that he could interpret, there were other strange sounds. It was those which made him begin to scream and scoff and groan in emulation with the storm. He had always been afraid when he was alone in the darkness of the forest. He liked the open sea and the bare rocks. Spirits and phantoms crept about among the trees. Suddenly he heard who it was who spoke in the storm. It was God, the great avenger, the God of justice. He was hunting him for the sake of his comrade. He demanded that he should deliver up the murderer to his vengeance. Then Tord began to speak in the midst of the storm. He told God what he wished to do, but had not been able. He had wished to speak to Burg Rhys and to beg him to make his peace with God, but he had been too shy. Bashfulness had made him dumb. "When I heard that the earth was ruled by a just God," he cried, "I understood that he was a lost man. I have lain and wept for my friend many long nights. I knew that God would find him out wherever he might hide, but I could not speak nor teach him to understand. I was speechless because I loved him so much. Ask not that I shall speak to him. Ask not that the sea shall rise up against the mountain." He was silent, and in the storm the deep voice, which had been the voice of God for him, ceased. It was suddenly calm, with a sharp sun and a splashing as of oars and a gentle rustle as of stiff rushes. These sounds brought Un's image before him. The outlaw cannot have anything, not riches nor women nor the esteem of men. If he should betray Burg, he would be taken under the protection of the law. But Un must love Burg after what he had done for her. There was no way out of it all. When the storm increased, he heard again steps behind him and sometimes a breathless panting. Now he did not dare to look back, for he knew that the white monk went behind him. He came from the feast at Burg Rhys's house, drenched with blood, with a gaping axe wound in his forehead. And he whispered, "Denounce him, betray him, save his soul. Leave his body to the pyre, that his soul may be spared. Leave him to the slow torture of the rack, that his soul may have time to repent." Tord ran. All this fright of what was nothing in itself grew, when it so continually played on the soul, to an unspeakable terror. He wished to escape from it all. As he began to run, again thundered that deep, terrible voice, which was God's. God himself hunted him with alarms that he should give up the murderer. Burg Rhys's crime seemed more detestable than ever to him. An unarmed man had been murdered, a man of God pierced with shining steel. It was like a defiance of the Lord of the world. And the murderer dared to live. He rejoiced in the sun's light and in the fruits of the earth as if the Almighty's arm were too short to reach him. He stopped, clenched his fists, and howled out a threat. Then he ran like a madman from the wood down to the valley. Tord hardly needed to tell his errand. Instantly 10 peasants were ready to follow him. It was decided that Tord should go alone up to the cave so that Berg's suspicions should not be aroused. But where he went, he should scatter peas so that the peasants could find the way. When Tord came to the cave, the outlaw sat on the stone bench and sewed. The fire gave hardly any light, and the work seemed to go badly. The boy's heart swelled with pity. The splendid Burg Rhys seemed to him poor and unhappy, and the only thing he possessed, his life, should be taken from him. Tord began to weep. "What is it?" asked Burg. "Are you ill? Have you been frightened?" Then for the first time Tord spoke of his fear. "It was terrible in the wood. I heard ghosts and saw specters. I saw white monks. Sedeth, boy. They crowded round me all the way up Broad Mountain. I ran, but they followed after and sang, 'Can I never be rid of the sound? What have I to do with them? I think that they could go on to one who needed it more.' Are you mad tonight, Tord?" Tord talked, hardly knowing what words he used. He was free from all shyness. The words streamed from his lips. "They are all white monks, white, pale as death. They all have blood on their cloaks. They drag their hoods down over their brows, but still the wound shines from under. The big red gaping wound from the blow of the axe." "The big red gaping wound from the blow of the axe?" Is it I who perhaps have struck it? Why shall I see it? The saints only know, Tord, said Berg Reese, pale and with terrible earnestness, what it means that you see a wound from an axe. I killed the monk with a couple of knife thrusts. Tord stood trembling before Berg and wrung his hands. They demand you of me. They want to force me to betray you. Who? The monks? They, yes, the monks. They show me visions. They show me her, Un. They show me the shining, sunny sea. They show me the fisherman's camping ground, where there is dancing and merrymaking. I close my eyes, but still I see. Leave me in peace, I say. My friend is murdered, but he is not bad. Let me be, and I will talk to him, so that he repents and atones. He shall confess his sin and go to Christ's grave. We will both go together to the places which are so holy that all sin is taken away from him who draws near them. What do the monks answer? Asked Berg. They want to have me saved. They want to have me on the rack and wheel. Shall I betray my dearest friend? I ask them, continued Tord. He is my world. He has saved me from the bear that had his paw on my throat. We've been cold together and suffered every want together. He has spread his bearskin over me when I was sick. I have carried wood and water for him. I have watched over him while he slept. I have fooled his enemies. Why do they think that I am the one who will betray a friend? My friend will soon of his own accord go to the priest and confess. Then we will go together to the land of atonement. Berg listened earnestly, his eyes sharply searching Tord's face. You shall go to the priest and tell him the truth, he said. You need to be among people. Does that help me if I go alone? For your sin, death, and all his specters follow me. Do you not see how I shudder at you? You have lifted your hand against God himself. No crime is like yours. I think that I must rejoice when I see you on rack and wheel. It is well for him who can receive his punishment in this world and escapes the wrath to come. Why did you tell me of the just God? You compel me to betray you. Save me from that sin. Go to the priest. And he fell on his knees before Berg. The murderer laid his hand on his head and looked at him. He was measuring his sin against his friend's anguish, and it grew big and terrible before his soul. He saw himself at variance with the will which rules the world. Repentance entered his heart. Woe to me that I have done what I have done, he said. That which awaits me is too hard to meet voluntarily. If I give myself up to the priests, they will torture me for hours. They will roast me with slow fires. And is not this life of misery, which we lead in fear and want, penance enough? Have I not lost lands and home? Do I not live parted from friends and everything which makes a man's happiness? What more is required? When he spoke so, Tord sprang up wild with terror. Can you repent? He cried. Can my words move your heart? Then come instantly. How could I believe that? Let us escape. There's still time. Berg Reese sprang up, he too. You have done it, then. Yes, 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 I've betrayed you, but come quickly. Come as you can repent. They will let us go. We shall escape them. The murderer bent down to the floor where the battle axe of his ancestors lay at his feet. You son of a thief, he said, hissing out the words. I have trusted you and loved you. But when Tord saw him bend for the axe, he knew that it was now a question of his own life. He snatched his own axe from his belt and struck at Berg before he had time to raise himself. The edge cut through the whistling air and sank in the bent head. Berg Reese fell head foremost to the floor. His body rolled after. Blood and brains spouted out. The axe fell from the wound. In the matted hair, Tord saw a big red gaping hole from the blow of an axe. The peasants came rushing in. They rejoiced and praised the deed. You will win by this, they said to Tord. Tord looked down at his hands as if he saw there the fetters with which he had been dragged forward to kill him he loved. They were forged from nothing, of the rush's green light, of the play of the shadows, of the song of the storm, of the rustling of the leaves, of dreams were they created. And he said aloud, God is great. But again the old thought came to him. He fell on his knees beside the body and put his arm under his head. Do him no harm, he said. He repents. He is going to the Holy Sepulchre. He is not dead. He is not a prisoner. We were just ready to go when he fell. The white monk did not want him to repent, but God, the God of justice, loves repentance. He lay beside the body, talked to it, wept and begged the dead man to awake. The peasants arranged a bier. They wished to carry the peasant's body down to his house. They had respect for the dead and spoke softly in his presence. When they lifted him up on the bier, Tord rose, shook the hair back from his face, and said with a voice which shook with sobs, "Say to Un, who made Berg Rhys a murderer, that he was killed by Tord the fisherman, whose father is a wrecker and whose mother is a witch, because he taught him that the foundation of the world is justice." And that story was The Outlaws by Selma Lagerlöf from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Treasury of Great Short Stories, published by Amaranth Press. All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot. They didn't say anything about this in the books, I thought, as the snow blew in through the gaping doorway and settled on my naked back. I lay face down on the cobbled floor in a pool of nameless muck, my arm deep inside the straining cow, my feet scrabbling for a toehold between the stones. I was stripped to the waist, and the snow mingled with the dirt and the dried blood on my body. I could see nothing outside the circle of flickering light thrown by the smoky oil lamp which the farmer held over me. No, there wasn't a word in the books about searching for your ropes and instruments in the shadows, about trying to keep clean in a half bucket of tepid water, about the cobbles digging into your chest, nor about the slow numbing of the arms, the creeping paralysis of the muscles as the fingers tried to work against the cow's powerful, expulsive efforts. There was no mention anywhere of the gradual exhaustion, the feeling of futility, and the little far-off voice of panic. My mind went back to that picture in the obstetrics book, a cow standing in the middle of a gleaming floor while a sleek veterinary surgeon in a spotless parturition overall inserted his arm to a polite distance. He was relaxed and smiling. The farmer and his helpers were smiling. Even the cow was smiling. There was no dirt or blood or sweat anywhere. That man in the picture had just finished an excellent lunch and had moved next door to do a bit of calving just for the sheer pleasure of it, as a kind of dessert. He hadn't crawled shivering from his bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and bumped over 12 miles of frozen snow, staring sleepily ahead until the lonely farm showed in the headlights. He hadn't climbed half a mile of white fellside to the doorless barn where his patient lay. I tried to wiggle my way an extra inch inside the cow. The calf's head was back, and I was painfully pushing a thin looped rope towards its lower jaw with my fingertips. All the time, my arm was being squeezed between the calf and the bony pelvis. With every straining effort from the cow, the pressure became almost unbearable. Then she would relax, and I would push the rope another inch. I wondered how long I would be able to keep this up. If I didn't snare that jaw soon, I would never get the calf away. I groaned, set my teeth, and reached forward again. Another little flurry of snow blew in, and I could almost hear the flakes sizzling on my sweating back. There was sweat on my forehead, too, and it trickled into my eyes as I pushed. There's always a time at a bad calving when you begin to wonder if you will ever win the battle. I had reached this stage. Little speeches began to flit through my brain. Perhaps it would be better to slaughter this cow. Her pelvis is so small and narrow that I can't see a calf coming through. Or, she's a good fat animal and really of the beef type, so don't you think it would pay you better to get the butcher? Or perhaps, this is a very bad presentation. In a roomy cow, it would be simple enough to bring the head round, but in this case, it is just about impossible. Of course, I could have delivered the calf by embryotomy, by passing a wire over the neck and sawing off the head. So many of these occasions ended with the floor strewn with heads, legs, heaps of intestines. There were thick textbooks devoted to the countless ways you could cut up a calf. But none of it was any good here, because this calf was alive. At my furthest stretch, I had got my finger as far as the commissure of the mouth and had been startled by a twitch of the little creature's tongue. It was unexpected because calves in this position are usually dead. asphyxiated by the acute flexion of the neck and the pressure of the dam's powerful contractions. But this one had a spark of life in it, and if it came out, it would have to be in one piece. I went over to my bucket of water, cold now and bloody, and silently soaped my arms. Then I lay down again, feeling the cobbles harder than ever against my chest. I worked my toes between the stones, shook the sweat from my eyes, and for the 100th time thrust an arm that felt like spaghetti into the cow, alongside the little dry legs of the calf, like sandpaper tearing against my flesh, then to the bend in the neck and so to the ear, and then agonizingly along the side of the face toward the lower jaw, which had become my major goal in life. It was incredible that I had been doing this for nearly 2 hours, fighting as my strength ebbed to push a little noose around that jaw. I had tried everything else, repelling a leg, gentle traction with a blunt hook in the eye socket, but I was back to the noose. It had been a miserable session all through. The farmer, Mr. Dinsdale, was a long, sad, silent man of few words who always seemed to be expecting the worst to happen. He had a long, sad, silent son with him, and the two of them had watched my efforts with deepening gloom. But worst of all had been Uncle. When I had first entered the hillside barn, I'd been surprised to see a little bright-eyed old man in a pork-pie hat settling down comfortably on a bale of straw. He was filling his pipe and clearly looking forward to the entertainment. "Now then, young man," he cried in the nasal twang of the West Riding, "I'm Mr. Dinsdale's brother. I farm over in Listendale." I put down my equipment and nodded. "How do you do? My name is Harriet." The old man looked me over piercingly. "My vet is Mr. Broomfield. Expect you'll have heard of him. Everybody knows him, I reckon. Wonderful man, Mr. Broomfield, especially at calving. Do you know, I've never seen him beat yet." I managed a wan smile. Any other time I would have been delighted to hear how good my colleague was, but somehow not now. Not now. In fact, the words set a mournful little bell tolling inside me. "No, I'm afraid I don't know, Mr. Broomfield," I said, taking off my jacket, and more reluctantly peeling my shirt over my head. "But I haven't been around these parts very long." Uncle was aghast. "You don't know him? Well, you're the only one as doesn't. They think the world of him in Listendale, I can tell you." He lapsed into a shocked silence and applied a match to his pipe. Then he shot a glance at my goose-pimpled torso. "Strips like a boxer, does Mr. Broomfield. Never seen such muscles on a man." A wave of weakness coursed sluggishly over me. I felt suddenly leaden-footed and inadequate. As I began to lay out my ropes and instruments on a clean towel, the old man spoke again. "And how long have you been qualified, may I ask?" "Oh, about 7 months." "7 months," Uncle smiled indulgently, tamped down his tobacco, and blew out a cloud of rank blue smoke. "Well, there's not like a bit of experience, I always say. Mr. Broomfield's been doing my work now for over 10 years, and he really knows what he's about. No, you can have your book learning. Give me experience every time." I tipped some antiseptic into the bucket and lathered my arms carefully. I knelt behind the cow. "Mr. Broomfield always puts some special lubricating oils on his arms first," Uncle said, pulling contentedly on his pipe. "He says you get infection of the womb if you just use soap and water." I made my first exploration. It was the burdened moment all vets go through when they first put their hands into a cow. Within seconds, I would know whether I'd be putting on my jacket in 15 minutes or whether I had hours of hard labor ahead of me. I was going to be unlucky this time. It was a nasty presentation. Head back and no room at all. More like being inside an undeveloped heifer than a second calver. And she was bone dry. The waters must have come away from her hours ago. She had been running out on the high fields and had started to calve a week before her time. That was why they had to bring her into this half-ruined barn. Anyway, it would be a long time before I saw my bed again. "Well, now, what have you found, young man?" Uncle's penetrating voice cut through the silence. "Head back, eh? You won't have much trouble, then. I've seen Mr. Broomfield do 'em like that. He turns calf right round and brings it out back legs first." I had heard this sort of nonsense before. A short time in practice had taught me that all farmers were experts with other farmers' livestock. When their own animals were in trouble, they tended to rush to the phone for the vet, but with their neighbors they were confident, knowledgeable, and full of helpful advice. And another phenomenon I had observed was that their advice was usually regarded as more valuable than the vet's. Like now, for instance, Uncle was obviously an accepted sage, and the Dinsdales listened with deference to everything he said. Another way with a job like this, continued Uncle, is to get a few strong chaps with ropes and pull the thing out, head back and all. I gasped as I felt my way around. I'm afraid it's impossible to turn a calf completely round in this small space, and to pull it out without bringing the head round would certainly break the mother's pelvis. The Dinsdales narrowed their eyes. Clearly they thought I was hedging in the face of Uncle's superior knowledge. And now, 2 hours later, defeat was just round the corner. I was just about whacked. I had rolled and groveled on the filthy cobbles while the Dinsdales watched me in morose silence, and Uncle kept up a non-stop stream of comment. Uncle, his ruddy face glowing with delight, his little eyes sparkling, hadn't had such a happy night for years. His long trek up the hillside had been repaid 100-fold. His vitality was undiminished. He had enjoyed every minute. As I lay there, eyes closed, face stiff with dirt, mouth hanging open, Uncle took his pipe in hand and leaned forward on his straw bale. "You're about beat, young man," he said with deep satisfaction. "Well, I've never seen Mr. Broomfield beat, but he's had a lot of experience. And what's more, he's strong, really strong. That's one man you couldn't tire." Rage flooded through me like a draft of strong spirit. The right thing to do, of course, would be to get up, tip the bucket of bloody water over Uncle's head, run down the hill and drive away, away from Yorkshire, from Uncle, from the Dinsdales, from this cow. Instead, I clenched my teeth, braced my legs, and pushed with everything I had, and with a sensation of disbelief I felt my noose slide over the sharp little incisor teeth and into the calf's mouth. Gingerly, muttering a prayer, I pulled on the thin rope with my left hand and felt the slip knot tighten. I had hold of that lower jaw. At last I could start doing something. "Now hold this rope, Mr. Dinsdale, and just keep a gentle tension on it. I'm going to repel the calf, and if you pull steadily at the same time, the head ought to come round." "What if the rope comes off?" asked Uncle hopefully. I didn't answer. I put my hand in against the calf's shoulder and began to push against the cow's contractions. I felt the small body moving away from me. "Now a steady pull, Mr. Dinsdale, without jerking." And to myself, "Oh God, don't let it slip off." The head was coming round. I could feel the neck straightening against my arm, then the ear touched my elbow. I let go the shoulder and grabbed the little muzzle. Keeping the teeth away from the vaginal wall with my hand, I guided the head till it was resting where it should be, on the forelimbs. Quickly I extended the noose till it reached behind the ears. "Now pull on the head as she strains." "Nay, you should pull on the legs now," cried Uncle. "Pull on the bloody head rope, I tell you," I bellowed at the top of my voice, and felt immediately better as Uncle retired, offended, to his bale. With traction, the head was brought out, and the rest of the body followed easily. The little animal lay motionless on the cobbles, eyes glassy and unseeing, tongue blue and grossly swollen. "It'll be dead, bound to be," grunted Uncle, returning to the attack. I cleared the mucus from the mouth, blew hard down the throat, and began artificial respiration. After a few pressures on the ribs, the calf gave a gasp, and the eyelids flickered. Then it started to inhale, and one leg jerked. Uncle took off his hat and scratched his head in disbelief. "By God, it's alive! I'd have thought it'd sure be dead after you messed about all that time." A lot of the fire had gone out of him, and his pipe hung down empty from his lips. "I know what this little fellow wants," I said. I grasped the calf by its forelegs and pulled it up to its mother's head. The cow was stretched out on her side, her head extended wearily along the rough floor. Her ribs heaved, her eyes were almost closed. She looked past caring about anything. Then she felt the calf's body against her face, and there was a transformation. Her eyes opened wide, and her muzzle began a snuffling exploration of the new object. Her interest grew with every sniff, and she struggled onto her chest, nosing and probing all over the calf, rumbling deep in her chest. Then she began to lick him methodically. Nature provides a perfect stimulant massage for a time like this, and the little creature arched his back as the coarse papillae of the tongue dragged along his skin. Within a minute he was shaking his head and trying to sit up. I grinned. This was the bit I liked, the little miracle. I felt it was something that would never grow stale, no matter how often I saw it. I cleaned as much of the dried blood and filth from my body as I could, but most of it had caked on my skin, and not even my fingernails would move it. It would have to wait for the hot bath at home. Pulling my shirt over my head, I felt as though I had been beaten for a long time with a thick stick. Every muscle ached. My mouth was dried out, my lips almost sticking together. A long, sad figure hovered near. "How about a drink?" asked Mr. Dinsdale. I could feel my grimy face cracking into an incredulous smile. A vision of hot tea well laced with whiskey swam before me. "That's very kind of you, Mr. Dinsdale. I'd love a drink. It's been a hard 2 hours." "Nay," said Mr. Dinsdale, looking at me steadily. "I meant for the cow." I began to babble. "Oh, yes, of course. Certainly, by all means, give her a drink. She must be very thirsty. It'll do her good. Certainly, certainly, give her a drink." I gathered up my tackle and stumbled out of the barn. On the moor it was still dark, and a bitter wind whipped over the snow, stinging my eyes. As I plodded down the slope, Uncle's voice, strident and undefeated, reached me for the last time. "Mr. Broomfield doesn't believe in giving a drink after calving. Says it chills the stomach." And that story was All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot, from Treasury of Great Short Stories, published by Amaranth Press. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio.